Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. So, step one, we'll just get right into it. Powerlessness over alcohol. I'm powerless in two ways. Once I start, I can't stop. And that happened to me at 14. I was on a cruise with my best friend and her family, completely ruined the family trip by almost dying and all. And I woke up and they told me all the stuff that happened that night. I was crawling under lawn chairs trying to get more vodka after they took it away from me. No, it wasn't. Don't remember it. Threw up over the side of the ship, pants fell down, dragged to the makeshift hospital at the bottom deck of the ship. All this stuff happened. And I didn't quite believe any of that, really, until I got sober was when I kind of digested the idea that that stuff probably did happen. But I found it interesting that I was going for more alcohol after I wasn't there anymore. Because I didn't go for more alcohol. You know, I don't remember that. But my body did. And that's how I reacted almost every single time. Actually, every single time I drank, I wanted more. There were some times where, you know, I was able to curb it or smoke weed or snort coke instead. But almost all the time, I had that experience where once I started, it just, I didn't know where I was going to end up. I didn't know how many I was going to have. And I remember trying to control that, obviously by trying to stop, which is the other part of how I'm powerless. Once I stop, I can't stay stopped. But there were times where I tried to moderate. You know, when you're having trouble with alcohol, you either try and drink less or try not to drink. But I was convinced that I was going to be able to drink less. And I remember taking a certain amount of money with me to the bar and coming home with about $100 worth more of liquor in me than the money I took. I thought my roommates were stealing my money, smoking my cigarettes. I'm pretty sure that was me in blackouts. I blacked out almost every time I drank the last 2 years that I drank. Threw up almost every night, but that's what happens when you drink. I didn't think that there was, really didn't think there was a different way for me to live. Because when I did attempt to moderate, it always turned out not to work. And when I attempted to stop, no matter how much fear, knowledge, psych wards, that I did medication, tried a lot of different things, but I wasn't able to stay stopped. First time I tried to stop was when I was 14, and, you know, I almost died, and my parents grounded me forever. So I decided to stop drinking, and it says in the book that there's this guy that didn't realize that that might not be in his control, you know, and that was me. It didn't even cross my mind that I wasn't going to be able to stop. You know, I made a decision. I was 14 years of life up to that point. Anytime I made a decision to do something or not do something, I did or didn't do it. But this was different. And I really didn't know that it was different for a really long time. Even after I picked up that first drink after that, I was able to talk myself into the idea that, well, I'll do it differently this time, or I deserve it. You know, if you had my parents, that was my motto growing up. You know, if you lived in my house, you would drink too. Next time I remember really trying to stop, I was 16, I came out of a psych ward and realized I really wasn't that crazy from being in there. Some people are really crazy. I was in group A. Group B was, I was not in group B, I'll just put it that way. But I got out of the psych ward and decided to stop again, and I lasted 3.5 weeks. I was 16 years old. They did not put me in an adolescent program, Flight Deck 5 North. And I stopped for 3.5 weeks, obviously proving that I'm not an alcoholic. You know, it's actually in insane thinking. You know, they talk about a hot stove in our textbook. And the idea that I haven't touched a hot stove in 20 days, 3 weeks, 30 freaking years, the idea that I haven't touched it and that I'm going to go touch it again and it's not going to burn makes no sense, no matter how long it's been since I've touched a hot stove. But in my mind, I've exhibited such control over the stove that now I can touch it because it's been 3.5 weeks. It makes no sense. But that's what would go on in my head when it came to alcohol. And the idea of an allergy, you know, I mentioned once I started, I couldn't stop. The allergy wouldn't be an issue if once I stopped, I could stay stopped, right? It just wouldn't be an issue. I mean, I have an allergy to walnuts, and if I ingest walnuts, perhaps I need to go to the hospital. So I go to the hospital, and the doctor fixes me up, shoots me up with Benadryl, saline, whatever it is they do. It's happened a couple times. So I leave, and on the way out, the doctor might say something like, oh, don't eat walnuts anymore. You'll be fine, you know? And that's all we got to do. But like with alcoholism, I go home and think about walnuts constantly. Cannot stop thinking about it. Think that it's going to solve every problem in my life. Alcohol and drugs. I cannot stop thinking about it. The doctor could say, just don't drink anymore on my way out. And I could completely agree. Completely. It would be a bad idea. But I'll drink again. The time and place always came when I drank again. So I still have the allergy to alcoholism. By the grace of God, I haven't had a drink or a drug since June 18th, 2001. And it's a result of this work. I have to say, the idea of being powerless over alcohol means that I don't choose when I do drink and I don't choose when I don't. So I didn't pick June 18th for any good reason. It's not, you know, anybody's birthday, it's not a holiday, really not anything special, but for some reason I was separated from drugs and alcohol that day. Circumstances, the way they fell, I ended up telling my parents a lot more than I had told my parents in many, many years, and, you know, to this day I kind of think that it was more of a divine, because as the words are coming out of my mouth, I'm like, holy shit, oh no! Because I knew what that meant. And am I allowed to curse? Cool. Because it's going to happen. it already did. So as the words are coming out of my mouth, I knew what that was going to mean. And I was quarantined in my home for 5 days until rehab had a bed. And I went up to rehab. And, you know, my story of recovery actually started. And suddenly, as I got sober, all the stuff that had happened prior to me getting sober started to matter. Like when I was 14 and almost died of alcohol poisoning, I did not talk about that ever until I got sober. It wasn't like anything that I ever discussed. I remember someone was reading my palm. They're like, you had a near-death experience. I was like, no. No, I didn't. You know, I just found that interesting. I never thought about it until I got sober when it actually meant something and it had part and it was part of my first step. You know, and it actually became part of my second step. The first time I had like a, I came in atheist, agnostic, I don't know what I was, but I didn't like God. I didn't believe in the idea of God. I was pretty sure that I needed to be right, and since I don't know what God is, F it. So that was kind of how I felt. I get to rehab, and we're sitting down, and we're talking about our drugs and alcohol, and I notice that on the wall. And one, check, got it, psh, whatever. Two, what are they talking about? Power who? And then God, and three, I completely was shut off from that. That made no sense to me, how God had anything to do with me not drinking. Like, absolutely no sense whatsoever. I'm trying to get over there, you know, to not drinking anymore. To be honest, at the time, I just thought I needed to stop snorting coke, that I'd probably be able to drink again someday. But anyway, I wanted to get there, okay? And you're telling me to go that way, and that I'll eventually get there if I go that way. And I didn't quite understand how that was possible, but I did find that it is the easier, softer way, even though it appears longer and like it's never going to get to where I'm trying to go. Because there's like a big wall, brick wall, you know, between me and actually just doing what I want to do. And that comes to a lot of aspects in my life, not just drugs and alcohol. You know, when people would say they'd work on themselves, you know, I decided, well, I don't want to be mean anymore. You know, so I'd go home and work on it. and, like, still be mean. We'll just, as an example of a character defect, still a bitch. And, you know, I couldn't figure out why these promises that they read in the meetings weren't coming true for me, why I wasn't able to fix everything. And it, you know, was shown to me that it's actually what I'm supposed to be working on is my relationship with God, and that somehow all the other stuff falls into place if it's supposed to. You know, my idea of my wildest dreams when I came in here is certainly different than my life today, which means that it was beyond my wildest dreams. I never thought that I would be sober, and the most important thing about being sober really isn't that I haven't had a drink or drug, but that I don't crave it, I don't want it, I'm not miserable. That's the miracle of AA. But, so, yeah, don't believe in God. And they're telling me that there's this God thing that I have to tap into. By the time I left rehab, I was a little more open to the idea. I was willing to believe that there might possibly be a power greater than me. Saying it like that sounds silly, but that's where I was. Eventually, I didn't like the word God because that meant what I grew up with. So I called it Amelia, and I felt like I was talking to the wall. And I was like, "Dear Amelia, thank you for keeping me sober today." You know, and that's what they told me to do, and that's what I did. And that's where my relationship with God started. And it does tell us that it can start anywhere. If you are against the idea of God, or don't believe in God, or hate God, you can start anywhere. You know, there's a lot of this controversy around the doorknob thing. I don't know if you guys have heard that in AA, but, like, you know, you can't pick a doorknob, and then, like, you could pick anything. And a lot of people feel differently, but I really honestly wouldn't get in the way of someone if they told me that the doorknob was what it was about, because mine was Amelia and did not exist. So, you know, whatever it takes, for you to be a little more open-minded about the ideas, whatever you need to do. But for me, I remember that when I was 14, the first time I started to think about that as something different than I had always thought about, I started to think that maybe God saved me that day. You know, my mother, when I got home from that cruise, said, "You better go back to church." She doesn't talk like that. "Better go back to church. God saved you." And I was like, "No, a little doctor didn't speak English at the bottom of the cruise ship saved me. Thank you very much." You know, and that's how I felt. And it wasn't until, you know, I came around these rooms and people started talking about this God thing that I was like, maybe there was a purpose. They talk about this primary purpose. You know, maybe there was a reason I didn't die that night. So I'm becoming more open-minded to the idea of God. I have a sponsor. My first sponsor this is her story. She fell, hit her head, went to the hospital, and got sober. That's not my story at all. You know, I can't tell you how many times I hit my head or ended up in the hospital. That didn't keep me sober. You know, she was different from me. So different, I decided I needed a different sponsor because, you know, she just stopped because one bad thing happened. One bad thing happened when I was 14, and that was the beginning of the movie, you know what I mean? Like, that was the beginning. I mean, it would be a pretty crappy movie if I had gotten sober at 14. Anyway. So, as I stayed sober, I got this other sponsor. There's Harley sponsor, and then there's hard-ass sponsor. So, Harley. She rode a Harley, thought that was awesome. That's why I asked her to be my sponsor. And she was taking me through the steps. And when we got to 3, this idea, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. Okay, wake up in the morning, turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him, and 2 minutes later, fuck up. That's how it was going for me, the third step. Couldn't quite figure it out. She told me to read the step book, awesome essay on the third step. No instructions whatsoever. Awesome essay. Could have read that, almost memorized it. Still sucked at step 3. And when I started going to these big book studies, and that's where I met Phil. I remember I walked in, and he's running the meeting, and I'm like, oh, my God, I must have a lot of time, you know, like, he sounds really good. And I had more time than him. I thought it was crazy. I'm like, what have I been doing, you know? But I started going to that meeting, and there was this chick, we'll call her hard ass, because she is. She came up to me after a meeting, and it was at this meeting that I heard for the first time the idea of the difference between a hard drinker and an alcoholic. And the difference is step one. A hard drinker can choose to stop or moderate, you know, if they almost die of alcohol poisoning or end up in the psych ward or hit their head, they can just stop or moderate even. Not me. So that's not what I thought that night, though. When we read the difference between a hard drinker and an alcoholic, being a alcoholic, I started to think I was a hard drinker and that I was 19, now I'm 20. You know, maybe that was a phase, maybe I'm going to be okay, maybe I can drink, you know, and this hard-ass chick comes up to me after, and she's like, you got a sponsor, you got a big book, I was like, yeah, yeah, and she's like, what step are you on? I'm like, I'm on step three, and I was like, you know, actually during this meeting, I started to think, like, maybe I'm just a hard drinker, maybe I don't even need to do this, and she's like, sounds like you're on step one there, killer, and she was right, you know, the idea that I'm powerless over alcohol had faded, you know, the idea that maybe I could drink one way or another had started to seep in. So she had a really good point. So I started meeting with her. She lived all the way in Rockville Center. I lived in Melville. I drove there once a week. We met for an hour, and we started reading the big book. She literally read it to me. It was really weird. But I sat, I listened, I made tons of marks everywhere. Things were just making sense. You know, when we read the doctor's opinion and learned about the allergy, I'd never heard of that before. As we read Bill's story, I even identified with Bill's story in rehab. I remember identifying then because we watched the movie My Name is Bill W. And there was this one scene in the movie where he's at a window and he's looking out at all the normal people, you know, like with strollers and happy families. And he just got home from rehab. I don't know. Well, it wasn't rehab then. He just got home from the hospital. And I don't know if it was the first, second, or third time. I can't remember. But he looked out, and Lois walks in, his wife, and he turns to her, and he goes, after everything I've been through, I just want a drink. And I'm sitting there, 19 years old, in 2001, and identifying with this dude from 1939, well, it was 1934, I guess, at the time, you know, white, middle-aged businessman. Like, what do I have in common with him? So I thought it was pretty interesting. But anyway, as we read Bill's story in the book, I identified more and more, and she kind of brought it alive with her own experience, which is what I try and do when I work with alcoholics today, you know, because the book is kind of old, and there's certain things that, like, didn't make sense to me when I read them by myself. And Kelly really ripped it apart and made a lot of sense out of it and brought it to present day, real life, her life, my life. That started to happen. We read the difference between a hard drinker and an alcoholic, and lo and behold, this time, I was an alcoholic after reading with her for a few weeks and identified with the loss of control and the inability to stop or moderate. Identified for, like, the first time really ever. I raised my hand and said I was an alcoholic for well over a year, but I had no idea what that meant. I really didn't. It wasn't until I read with Kelly that I actually found out what was my issue. And it had taken a very long time for me to figure out the drugs and alcohol were my problem, right? Like, I finally get to rehab. It's been, like, 6 years of hell, you know, another year. Finally realizing that's my problem. And then Kelly's ripping that apart completely and telling me alcohol and drugs have nothing to do with, they're just a symptom of my problem. I'm my problem. That's a little hard to digest. You know, and I had to agree, because at a year and a half sober, meeting with her, I have to say I was even a little sicker than I was a year and a half earlier when I went to rehab. I had lots of amends that I had to make that were not prior. There were a lot. There were a lot prior to getting sober, but there were quite a few I had to make because of my first year and a half sober. You know, I didn't know what I was doing, ran amok. I knew everything about everybody in AA. I knew what you were going to say. I knew what I had to do. I knew what I had to do. And you know, she really ripped that apart for me, and I needed that ripped apart. those preconceived notions, those ideas that had been put in my head in the last year and a half. You know, we kind of digested, I had to digest the idea that meeting makers make meetings. And that sometimes, for a non-alcoholic, that's good enough. There's plenty of non-alcoholics in these rooms. All you need to do is want to stop. But for me, as a real alcoholic, and not judging anybody else, but for me as a real alcoholic, that shit didn't work. You know, I could cut it in half by sharing it as many times as you want. It's got like a long half-life. You know, the half-life on that thing is long. And, you know, it just didn't work for me. Waking up instead of coming to, falling asleep instead of passing out was great for like a week. You know, like these things don't last for me. The fear didn't last. You know, again, like I said, I started to think in that meeting. So when we got to the third step, I was like waiting for what Kelly was going to do, because I had a big problem with the third step, obviously. I've been on it for like a year, and I had an issue with it. So we get to it, and we're reading all this stuff. You know, going back to my life being unmanageable, it actually says in the book that I'm delusional if I think that I'm going to be happy if I only manage well. That it's actually delusional, and I absolutely agree. Still to this day, I do not manage my life very well. When I ask God for some guidance, things go a little better. I'm going to say a lot better, actually. I'm going to go off the limb there. A lot better. They go a lot better. So anyway, when I was reading that with Kelly, we read through a whole bunch of stuff, starting to look at things in a different light. Maybe I'm the one trying to put people in different spots and make them stay, and then I get mad because they don't do what I think they should do for that. That's how it was going. And it started to actually make sense, though. And we read the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to do with me and build with me as thou wilt. Leave me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. So, you know, she dissected that too, and she said, you know, I'm asking for God to relieve me of my problems, not so that I'm awesome, you know, not so that I don't have problems, but so that other people might say, like, shit, Chris got better, you know, maybe I could get better. So we continued to read, and it was like, basically, like, you know, it said a little thing about the prayer, and then it was like, next, we launched onto a course of vigorous action. I was like, whoa, where was three? You know, like, okay, we read a prayer, but, like, how do I do three? How do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him every day? And she's like, if you could just do that, there'd only be three steps. You know, like, one, two, three. Like, what more is there? Just turn your will and your life over to the care of God. She's like, it says decision. I can make a decision to go to the beach. If I never go to the beach, it doesn't really matter. So the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God was what I needed to do to come to a third step experience. Not actually do it. Because again, if I could, why are there, you know, not, why? Why do anything more? So I was kind of floored by that, because no one really pointed out, no major decisions in the first year, right? That's what they pointed out. No one pointed out that I had a really big decision to make, you know? No relationships in the first year. I'm forming a relationship, the most important relationship of my life, with a higher power. I'm being facetious, but I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan of, what do they call them? Suggestions. I'm not a fan. I'm not the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct, including my sponsees, but anyway. So that's all I had to do to understand step three, make a decision. Did I think it was a good idea if God kind of took the driver's seat and I, like, let go of it and stopped white-knuckling? Yeah, I think it's a good idea. Check. Moving along. You know, and we'll get into that next week, but I guess I'm going to stop there. Thank you.